Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host today. It's been a while since I last had the opportunity to sit down with the always colourful recovery agent, William Cobra Storbs. Cobra, welcome to the program.
My pleasure, Simon, and it's an honor that you would have me here today. Thank you.
I was sat outside earlier this morning, freezing to death. Hard to believe that here we are in southern Mississippi and it's 40 degrees, but yeah, that's the way it goes. And I was mulling over this program and talking to you, and in my mind, you fall into a small cadre of people that I know. I think the best way to describe it is everyone thinks they know a person, but they really do not. I've been working with a guy recently. I'll keep his name off the air. He's a household name in the technology and movie industry, and everyone bases their opinion on his public appearances, but that's not the real person. In my mind, you also fall into this category. So I'd like to start at the very beginning. You know, tell us a little bit about yourself. For example, where were you born? Where did you grow up?
I was born in Washington, D.C. I grew up in a town called Ida, and that's just outside of Luray Caverns, Virginia, where the most beautiful caverns in the world exist, and that's where I first saw the light of day, back in 1957.
Were you a good kid in school, or were you a hellion?
I was a class clown, truth be known. I always liked to, you know, cut it up, and I failed second grade. We had moved around. We had moved around quite a bit. My dad worked for Goodyear, and we had moved from place to place, and I ended up not having enough time in front of any one teacher, so this teacher failed me, and I had to repeat second grade. What a horrific situation that was! Like, who failed second grade?
Right.
You laugh about it when you're 54, but when you're when you're four or five, however old you are when you're in second grade, it ain't a laughing matter at that point in your life. It's the world came to a crashing end.
So you, pretty much, you were, you were just, you were a small kid that, you know, traveled a lot with, with your parents.
Kind of. We moved around a little bit from, between West, by God, Virginia, and of course we have to say that. Most people just say West Virginia, but we Virginians have to say West by God. Between there, West Virginia was my father's hometown, and Virginia was my mother's, so we did a lot of moving back and forth, trying to find that perfect spot, I guess. I don't know. I was so young at that particular time to understand all the fine arts of trying to keep a family afloat and everything else.
Now, as I understand it, I might have this wrong, but I'm guessing that after you finished high school, you joined the armed forces?
No, not so fast. When I was 5 years old, I had my face literally ripped from my body by a German Shepherd, which my favorite dog to this day is a German Shepherd. But I had I was a victim of a dog that had tore me up. So I was kind of, you know, I was always teased as being Scarface. Now we find out that Scarface is somebody to deal with. I mean, and it really didn't do too awful bad, but it was earth-shattering. And as I grew up, I had taken a job when I was about 16, I guess. I worked in a coal company, sacking coal, and they were paying 4 cents a bag. And I could do 100 bags an hour, so $4 an hour back in 1973 was a good living, but it was only part-time. And one night, as young children do, young kids, juveniles, I had taken something that didn't belong to me. I'd actually went into my employer's safe and taken all the money out. And the next day, oh yeah, I was 16, I was a knucklehead. And the next day, I got sick at school. I'd been loaning money to everybody and doing all kinds of stuff. Man, I had more money. I could buy Sears, man. I had $43,000 and some change. And I turned myself in, basically, to the sheriff in the town, and I was promptly arrested and taken down for questioning, and I gave all the money back. I mean, I just couldn't live with myself that I had done that. So I gave all the money back and figured it would go away. The people that I had stolen from did not prosecute. In fact, they asked the judge, and of course they kept holding it over until I was becoming of an adult. This thing kept getting pushed aside, and one day I found myself in there, and I was 17 and a half, and I'm sure enough going to be charged as an adult. Now, so you have to understand that safe cracking is a 10-year deal in Virginia. Virginia has some very strict laws, and here I am at, you know, 16, 17, committed this crime, which I turned myself in and gave the money back. In fact, when they did the count on it, it had four extra dollars, and that was one of my pays that were in there too. I just commingled it all together. But in that, the people that I had stolen the money from asked the judge if they could conclude this business because they wanted me to come back to work. And they realized that they probably shouldn't have left certain things available to me. Or thank God that I'm the guy who stole it, because had a professional thief had stole it, they would have never gotten the money back. But they got the money back, and he spoke good to the judge, and I interrupted him, and the judge kind of, you know, I'm something for talking to judges. My goodness, I was talking to a judge this morning. Of course, I'll tell you that story later. But I bellered out to the judge, and I said, "No, Your Honor, please, I would like to go into the military." Well, I wasn't old enough to go into the military at that point in time, but in order for me to do that, there could not be any charges against me, because I didn't just want to go in the Army or something, which they would take you if you had a small record. I wanted to go into the United States Navy, and I wanted to make something of myself. And sure enough, the judge said, "Well, 6 months before you turn 18, if you so much as spit on the street, you're going to prison for 10 years. You understand me, son?" Oh, buddy, let me tell you what. I walked straight and narrow, not just for 6 months, but all the way up until I sit here today. Ain't no way that I want to go into no jail. And the people were so nice. I mean, they gave me they always offered me to have my job back and everything. But I went ahead and joined the United States Navy. My first base was Orlando, Florida. They've since closed that down. But I did my basic training in 1975, 1 month after the close of the Vietnam War. And I did my training there. And then I was sent to Jacksonville to VA 174, which were known as the Hellraisers. Well, perfect place for me to be. So I joined up with the Hellraisers out of Jacksonville. And then my permanent duty station ended up being NAS Cecil Field, which has been closed as well under the Clinton administration. But I served there as an airman attached to VA 105, the Gunslingers. So went from a Hellraiser to a Gunslinger. And little did I know, but this squadron, a fixed aircraft squadron, was assigned to USS Saratoga, CB-60, the Fighting Cock. I'm saying, man, a Hellraiser, a Gunslinger, now I'm a Fighting Cock. I mean, it teaches you how to do all this stuff, you know. So the first 6 months that I was in the United States Navy, I quit school, by the way. I'd graduate, I passed to the 12th grade from the 11th, and quit school and went into the Navy. And in 6 months' time, I graduated from Washington State University. They had a community college, which the government, Uncle Sam, doesn't give GEDs. They give high school diplomas. So they have actual instructors on the ship, and, you know, I did that. Then I did 2 years of college and started to start studying law. And, in fact, I think next summer I'm going to actually sit down for the bar exam. I've tinkered with it long enough. It's time to just go ahead and take the bar exam. But nonetheless, I had been around this world, not the country, the world, 2 times and graduated high school before my graduating class had ever got their final diplomas. So I thought that I had, you know, done very well for myself, even though it started out on some bad terms. I was a little knucklehead and got myself in trouble, but that was really the only trouble. And I would say this to folks that get in trouble. Now, anything that come up missing in that 6 months' time before I went in the military, you know who they were blaming. Oh, another safe got robbed. They blew this thing apart. So they were thinking I had stepped up my game, you know. So here come all the deputy sheriffs and everybody want to know where I was. Oh, where were you when the lights were shining bright? Day off, man, I was home, you know. I'd never steal nothing else. So, and then since that time, you know, I wouldn't mess with nothing. It's scary. But I had went all the way around the world twice. I was one of the first United States soldiers to go behind the Iron Curtain to split Yugoslavia. It's no longer, I guess, behind an Iron Curtain. They tore down a wall since then. But I went to split Yugoslavia. I did a whole tour in France and Spain and various places. I got to spend some time on the French Riviera. I was Cannes, France, and all the places were back in that day in 1975. I did the Bicentennial Cruise, which was 1976. And I got a chance to meet some real famous people that were over there holidaying and all that kind of stuff, and spent some time over there when hamburgers and Coca-Cola's was $5. $5 for the two of them, which was a lot of money, seemed like, but now they're, you know, probably more expensive. But it changed my life, and it was just a beautiful thing. I would recommend for any young person to, you know, serve the country and go in. So later on, I did the Bicentennial Cruise, and during that cruise, the United States Navy's been around since 1776, and 1976 was their 200th year anniversary. So to celebrate, the United States Navy decided that they were going to have everybody that possibly could on the various ships run 200 miles. Well, my God. But we found out we only had to run, you know, upwards of 10 miles a day if that's what you wanted to do. So out of several thousand that started this old race, about only 14 of us made the papers and finished the 200-mile run for the, you know, and I've seen a lot. I've seen they used to wear brown shoes, the officers used to, and we went through many changes. When I went in, it was the suit and tie, and then we changed back to the Cracker Jack uniform and everything. So I was what was called a 2x6 program, 2 years active duty, 2 years active reserve, 2 years inactive reserve, completing a 6-year stint in the United States Navy. And when I got back, I joined the construction battalion known as the Seabees, and finished out the rest of my 6 years in the Seabees, the construction battalion of the United States Navy. And pretty much that started me off into the construction industry for a very good long period of time.
Yeah, what actually did you do in the construction world? You've mentioned bits and pieces to me.
There's different kinds of folks in the construction world, you know. There's what they call general builders, general contractors, what I am, I'm the highest rated. I am a certified general contractor. It used to be referred to as a Class A general contractor. I'm certified in the state of Florida, state of Virginia, and a couple other states that I hold right now inactive license, but I could reactivate if I decided to go back into that profession. But my license enabled me, where everybody else leaves off with, I never did single-family homes. My license is for high-rises, high, anything over four stories as a certified general contractor. There's a lot more training that goes into it. It is a very, very difficult four-part test consisting of 2 days. The test is so well-guarded that Brinks delivers it. It's the most religious testing facility in the world that you'll ever go to, because about 2 seconds after you open the handbook, it's, oh, Jesus, oh, God, oh, my God, oh, Jesus. And you can't have any state-of-the-art computer systems. You have to use a regular old calculator, two number two pencils. And basically, they want to know, you know, it's a test for taking tests. I mean, just because you pass that doesn't mean you could build a building. But they would want to know, they would give you a land size and say, we want to move all the dirt from this end to that end, and we want to know how much it's going to cost to do that. And you have to start looking through all these different books to find out what a small wheeled transporter is. Oh, that's got a 5 brake horsepower. Well, you got to calculate all these numbers. And basically it's set that if you some kind of way know it, you have exactly enough time to do the formulas. It's all formulas. There's a lot of engineering that goes into it and stuff. So folks that, you know, well, I'm a general contractor. Well, what kind of general contractor? Are you a general builder? Did you build houses? Or are you a certified general contractor? That is the highest license that you can hold, and you have to know, you know, different things. Earthquake, hurricane. I mean, you have to pretty much be a dadgum engineer. So a lot of people don't know that about me because I got that old hillbilly swagger going on. So they think, well, you know, this is just one idiot kind of person. But I assure you that anybody that knows me knows that I was a leader in my industry, and even every industry I've ever been in, I've been a leader in my industry. In fact, I strive to be the best that I can be. It's the motto of the United States Navy. Be all you can be. Do it.
Okay. It begs the question, how on earth did you get involved in the colorful world of bail bonds and the whole investigation stuff?
Well, it kind of came at two different times. While we were off the coast of France, a good friend of mine, name was Smitty, I had taken him hunting in Virginia before we went on this big crusade across the world. And Smitty decided to go AWOL, and he jumped ship somehow or another in France, took a life raft, because the aircraft carrier was sitting, you know, a couple miles offshore because, you know, we're too deep in the water. They're about 20 stories high when you pull them out of the water. So a lot of that ship is underwater, so you can't get in but so close. So Smitty had decided to steal him a life raft, and he was out of there. Now, somehow or another, he made it from France all the way back to my hometown in Virginia and spent the summer with my younger brother up in a cabin in the woods that we had built. And the government is looking everywhere for this joker. And when I found out how some of the government agencies are, you know, it's kind of hard for them to catch people at times. There are certain ribbons and red tape, if you will, that they got to go through to get folks. And it started me to thinking. I said, you know, there must be some kind of business that you could get into that you could actually track people down. So then I found someone. Someone had shot some people and killed them and set the house on fire and went on a run. And the fella was happened to be in a well-known biker group. Well, I happen to know a lot about biker stuff, so, but, you know, I happen to think I might be able to know this guy. Sure enough, well, when I seen the amount of money, cash money, that I was handed for my efforts of figuring this all out, this is back in the late 70s, I decided right then and there that if I knew of any fugitives on the run, I was going to turn them in and get paid, because that was good money. I mean good money. When I say good money, I wouldn't want to disclose it on the air, but I'm telling you, good money. So I started doing this thing, and with my construction experience, and I worked for a company named Acoustai Engineering, and they did a lot of hiring of people. And this was back before you had the I-9, NIS, and all these different things. And most people on the run would go to work in construction industry. So you had a lot of, or had at that time, now it's tightened up a little bit, but back in the day you had a lot of fugitives. If you ever watched the movie Fugitive, he would go get odd jobs in construction sites. And they're like a magnet, day labor camps, and they would come, and construction was the way. And I started rounding them up, one here, one there, one here, one there, two here, two there. And then I decided, I hooked up with a guy, and he goes, listen, you ain't got to turn these fellers over to the police. You call me, and I'll find out if they're out on what's called bail bonds. I said, bail bonds? What the crap is that? So he told me, and we could get more money. I said, more money than this? Oh, yeah, a lot more money. So then I started self-apprehending, and I would go to work every day as a construction feller, and then when I owned my own business and everything, and I would get calls from other construction companies, hey, Cobra, you know this guy? I don't know. Let me run him real quick. I'd run him. Oh, yeah, he's one. Where's he at? Oh, he's going to be taking lunch down such and such. And, man, I'd run down there and put handcuffs on him, and off we would go. And I was making the rest and delivering them to deputy sheriffs and stuff. And somewhere along about the, I don't know, late 80s, early 90s, they changed the dadgum law. And you have to be a licensed bail bondsman to be putting your hands on anybody. So I got arrested one night and thrown on the ground, and this was a comical scene. We was in Fort Lauderdale at a place called a seafood place on 17th Street Causeway, and this biker feller was up in there. So we ran up in there, me and my partner, and we grabbed him, and it was unbecoming for us to have handcuffs. Now, I never said I had handcuffs. I never had handcuffs all the way up until probably I got my license, because that was just something taboo. So what we would use, we had what was called triple chains. That motorcycle, the second gear ratio on it had a triple chain. We had them made into belts and stuff, and we was all cool and everything. And we'd tie them up with anything, belts made of chains and shoelaces and all kinds of stuff. So you get this picture. We in Fort Lauderdale, and I got this feller hog-tied with a bunch of belt straps and stuff, and I'm standing on him. And we've called the bondsman to come pick him up, and here come the police. And what in the hell's going on? And I said, well, we got this guy right here. And, well, who are you? I said, well, we caught him for this fellow's coming by here. He's the wanted fugitive. Well, they got to talking to me and my partner and got us pulled to the side and put us in the back of the car. Next thing I know, this fugitive done got loosed and he's gone. And he's running down the road going up over the 17th Street Causeway Bridge. I'm like, man, there goes our money. We finally got talked. The bondsman shows up. He gets us out the car and tells us everything. Where's my man? Where's my guy? I said, this idiot got our attention off, and he's up there. So he went up there, and he was going to jump off the freaking bridge and decided better not do that. And we got him, and I decided to go and get my bail bond license. So I hooked up with a guy who's a good friend of mine now, Mr. Bob Dicker, probably listening. Shout out to you, Mr. Bob. And Bob Dicker is a former FBI agent, and he teaches the class on bail bonds. So I rode my Harley-Davidson up into the dead gum, I mean almost in the bail bond class, and freaked everybody out. I mean really flipped them out, because they had a real estate school going on at the same time for Gold Coast Real Estate. And Bob is actually the guy who actually named me Cobra. So I went through the 40, at that time it was 40 in-class hours. You had to do a criminal justice class, and you did a correspondence class through Gainesville, the big school of the Gators down here, and all this stuff. And after I passed everything, I decided, you know, I don't need a dadgum license. So I never went for my state finals. This was in the early 90s. So dadgum it, wouldn't you know it, I got arrested again, not taken to jail and charged, just detained. And so I said, well, that's enough of getting arrested. So finally I got my bail bond license in 1995. And been licensed ever since, except for my one little mishap where I lost it for a year waiting on the outcome of my deposition there, my case. But since the late 70s all the way up to current, I just passed over 8,551 fugitives to date. And of those, 212 have been charges for crimes against children. Two of them were charged murder. The guys are actually in prison now doing time for murder, and one terrorist. And unlike Dwayne, good friend of mine, you know, known as Dog the Bounty Hunter, and Leonard, the two of them together don't surpass my record. I am, and the reason being is I was in a position to be able to do that, being a general contractor in construction. And, you know, later on throughout the 90s and into the early 2000s, other companies would call me, and I would do backgrounds on probably 20 or 30 construction companies of people coming for work. And I'd run their background, and I had the access to find out that they were wanted and this, that, and the other. And if they didn't have a bail bond on them, then I would contact some of my buddies in the U.S. Marshal Service or the local sheriff's department and tell them where and when and have them picked up. And if they were bail bond, out on bonds, then I would go ahead and make the arrest and transport them to jail and get them signed off, arrest them, put them in jail, and take the paperwork back and get paid from the bail bondsman. So I started that a long time ago. My partner, God rest him, Eric Walton, had a company named Speedy Release Bail Bonds, and he had qualified me early on because just getting, you know, through the school and everything, you had to intern with someone, and I interned with him. And I had worked for Intel Investigations as an intern for them, and once I signed off and became a Class C investigator after 2 years of interning, then I qualified Eric as a PI, and he qualified me as a bail bondsman. So that's pretty much how I got into bail bonds and private investigation. They kind of go hand in hand for the simple reason there's certain things you know, you can investigate, but you can't arrest. And then there's other things that you know, like if I want to investigate you, I can't do that as a bail bondsman. I have no authority unless you're out on bond, then I can investigate you. But you need both licenses to, if you're going to go in the, you know, we call it a whore market. It's the worst of the worst, the dirt of the dirt. And if you're going to try to make money in it, you need to have both licenses.
Okay, without a lot of name-calling and muck-raking, your career took a bit of a hit a couple of years ago.
Yes.
Right. What happened, and what were the consequences?
Oh, severe. Consequences were severe. What had happened was, as I had received a phone call, as I've told you probably and told folks many times, I'd received a phone call from a lady who had information on the missing Kaylee case out of Orlando and swore that she knew where this child was seen, and she had been at a church, and there was a bread company that supplied bread there. And being that she was a citizen on patrol, she was actually a uniformed police person, helper, or whatever you call them, a citizen on patrol, I guess. But she had a police car and everything else. You know, you've seen them with the little yellow lights and stuff like that. She had contacted JAG, a good friend of mine, JAG, Bounty Hunter Girls. They had the show called The Bounty Girls out of Miami. And most people in my industry know me as being the guy. So JAG called me and said, listen, I received a call from a lady who probably has seen this little Kaylee Anthony case girl, this little girl, and would you mind, you know, meeting with her, talking to her, whatever? And I said, well, right now I'm chasing a murder suspect through Tennessee, Clarksville, Tennessee, and we're about to close on him, but as soon as I get done, I'll do it. So we caught the feller up there, and I left and came back and met this woman, and she sounded normal. Of course, she also said that Elvis Presley was alive, and so was JF Kennedy. So I'm like, oh, great, here we go. But in fairness, and at the sake of a child missing, and you know, her information and her job was credible, I went and checked it out in Glades County, and of course, they almost put me in jail over there because I could not disclose to them under Section 493. I don't have to disclose who I work for. That's none of nobody's business but mine and my clients, and if my client wants to give it up, fine. Well, technically, we weren't really working for nobody, but I was running down the lead. So here I am on a Sunday morning being threatened by a preacher that I'm going to jail, and the sheriff's got me in jail, and they're going to lock me up because I won't tell them who I'm working for, which is all nonsense. But I finally got out of that mess and called Jag back and said, don't have any information. I think the lady just put on the whack side, to be polite. So I'm in Orlando chasing a feller that's wanted for attempted murder. He had thrown something, a knife or something, at his girlfriend, and somehow or another he's skipping bond, and they said he was in Orlando. So I heard a big thing on the radio stating that there was going to be a little community thing at Suburban Drive, and they're going to pay retribute to the little girl. And I told my son, I says, you know, we ought to go over there. I said, if anybody has any right to be showing up there, it'd probably be me, because I damn near went to jail over this kid. I don't even know. So let's go by and pay our respects. I did. And I ran into Richard Grun, and he was the best-looking fella dressed there, and he had a little cross on, and I didn't know if he was who he was. I just knew that he was a man of the cloth, and I walked up to him, and I said, give my condolences to the family. And we got to talking for a few minutes. He introduced himself as Richard Grun, and I ended up forming a brotherhood with him. I mean, he's a likable guy and stuff, and he had told me how there was some issues going on in his life that he was actually akin to this case, that, you know, and we know the story that they were trying to put this rap on his son, Jesse. So I dove into that case for a period of time and unscrambled some of the things and caused them all to think and look in a different direction and leave my client and his son alone, except for attacking them on the internet like a lot of people do. But it stopped them from trying to place a charge on him. So a little bit of time went by, and lo and behold, Haley Cummins comes up missing. And Mr. Grun called me and asked me, he says, listen, I spoke to some people in this case, and this child, their family's dirt poor, and they don't really think that the police are doing everything they can, and they've been on it for over a month, and the press has been threatened, and they've pretty much been run out of town, and they try to kind of sweep this under the rug, seems to me. I don't know. Do you have available ability to go up there and take a look into this thing? And here I am now. I'm thinking, well, this must be God. This is a preacher, and a preacher's asking me to do this. So I esteem that as a high mantle. Like, ooh, this is pretty serious stuff. So when I asked some more questions about it, the press has been run off. So I contacted one of my friends out in Las Vegas, big bondsman fellow, a friend of mine, Jason Risback from Vegas Bail. And he told me to contact an Art Harris, and I did. And Art Harris said he'd love to, but, you know, he needed to be paid. So I had to figure out how to get Art paid. And then there's another little kid that could come up missing. You know, they wasn't doing so good with one they had, so this child needs some protection. And I figured, you know, I know an attorney that deals in this kind of stuff. So I contacted somebody, and that somebody went up, you know, and looked in about the affairs of this little child, I reckon. So, in all this, I'm wearing two different hats. I'm wearing investigator hat one day and bail bondsman the next. And I figured the only way you're going to find out anything is go into the underworld, because, you know, people are going to only talk to the police what they're going to say, and I have the ability to cross both lines. And, you know, really, for most of the community, they opened arms to me. They wanted this thing solved. The drug dealers wanted it solved because, man, they'd been getting pressure. Somebody said it was a drug deal thing went wrong, and they didn't need this. You know, they needed to be making their money doing their thing. And anybody that knows me in the industry knows one thing. If you owe me money, I'm coming to get it. And if I can't get my money, I'm getting you. So they feared not about, I mean, I've seen more dope in that town than I could want to see. And none of my business. That's none of my business whatsoever. I'm there strictly. That's why when I ended up in jail, that nothing sure has happened to me, because I had focus. My focus was, this child's missing. I need to find her, period. So I figured that, well, who's going to steal a kid in the middle of the night, 2 o'clock in the morning, you know? Who's going to do that? Well, I know a bunch of sexual predators and people like that do that, because them's the sorry rascals that do it. I don't think the child ran off into the night. You know, it was dark, it was cold, it was not something that a child would do in the woods. So I started searching. I searched a 5-mile area on the internet for anyone ever convicted of or anything about children molesting. Well, that was too far of a search, because the search ended up being over 200 individuals. So then I started narrowing the search down, narrowing it down, and I got down to within a mile of this area where this child came up missing, and one person's name come up, and that person's name was Daniel Snodgrass, and he was on bond for 2 counts of capital alleged. This is all alleged stuff, because to my knowledge, he's still in jail, and this is going back all the way to 07 when he was charged, but he was on bond for 2 counts of capital, which is serious, capital sexual battery on child under 12. So who bonded this knucklehead out? So I tracked down the bail bond company, and I got a hold of the company that actually wrote up. It turns out that I was appointed, meaning that I was fully licensed with this bail bond company and their insurance company, which at the time was Continental Heritage. And I was able to do anything in their name, sign their name, stamp bonds, write whatever I was, in as much, according to the state of Florida, appointed by this company, could do pretty much anything I wanted to do. Well, even given all that, I had made arrangements to get this individual's file. And I had monitored him for a minute and found out that he was violating the term and conditions of his bond. And I thought everything was a green light, and I had met with the powers to be, meaning the sheriff, the state attorney, FDLE, the prosecutor's office investigator. We all met on the side of the road, and I said, listen, I got about 9 files here of some folks that I'm going to be putting back in jail. I want to know if it's going to interfere with y'all's investigation. Mr. Hardy, Jeff Hardy, a good friend of mine, said, no, it's a personal matter. It's a civil matter. I said, specifically, I want to know about this particular individual, and that was the gentleman that was out on bond. And I said, I want to know about him. Have y'all, you know, we don't have any more form, anything. Whatever y'all do is, you know, that's civil matter. We understand, blah, blah, blah. Okay, fine. So after I found out that the police had already investigated him, and basically, you know, it wasn't really a whole lot going on there, my investigator started calling me and saying, listen, the feller's selling his furniture, he's doing this, this, this. Now, to me, that sounds like a feller that's fixing to run. So we watched him for 4 or 5 days, and a dreadful day, the worst, probably the worst day of my life, which probably will turn out to be the best day of my life, was March the 20th, 2009. I summoned the sheriff's office, and I explained to them that I was going to be affecting an arrest warrant, which, to me, is my terminology, arrest warrant. There was no warrant for his arrest. He was simply on bond, and I was going to terminate that bond status and, you know, take him in. So it might have been a little confusing to them. They showed up and decided that, oh, it's a civil matter. You're just going to put him back in jail. Yes. Well, we'll stand by down at the end of the road, and, you know, you do what you do. I said, all right. And most of this folks can see on YouTube. It was exclusive takedown part one, exclusive takedown part two. And they said they was going to stand by in case we got to fighting and they'd break us up, you know. So I go on up to the house. Mr. Nodgrass going to be a little jack rascal about it. He ain't going to come out and do the right thing. So I think I hear a gun stitching. And I know for sure, since follow-up investigation, there was a gun stitching up. And they had plans to kill me. This was a setup to where if I would have went in that house, they would have shot me dead or next week. And these things we know as a fact, which we'll discuss at another date, and I'll give you the full insight of it, and your hair will blow back. But nonetheless, I summoned the deputy sheriffs, and I said, you know, I'll need to come on up here and keep the peace. I'm going to go get this guy, but I think one of them got a gun. So when they came, you've seen the video, and they're standing there parade rest, and everything's fine and dandy, and I yoked this little rascal, and I trip him up and put him on the ground because he's nudging, trying to tell the cop that I don't work the case no more, and I'm thinking something's awful bad wrong here, but I'm not going to let my business interfere with the police by him touching the police because simple touch strike battery, you know, that, I didn't control my prisoner. So the insurance company didn't want to be involved in all this hoopla, so they decided to have me let him go. And then somehow or another, they convinced, because he was going to sue them, he's going to sue everybody, and he couldn't sue nobody, but they got all scaredy pants about it, and it was easier to throw me under the bus than to take a hit from him, I guess. So they told me to let him go, and I did. And he went and filed a charge that, you know, we were harassing him and everything. And the police, for whatever reason, they believed what the bail bondsman said, which, incidentally, both bondsmen are in prison, I mean, for lying to the police. I mean, that ought to give you some kind of clue, but Chuck Ingram and Dale Ingram both are done. I mean, they're done. So, you know, here we are dealing with a pack of liars and stuff, and the police, I mean, they had no choice, really, but to come after me, and they charged me with false imprisonment because the insurance company said that I did not have authority to do what I did. Well, apparently, I was out on bond for about near a year, and apparently somewhere along the line, somebody must have thought that I did have some type of apparent authority. So they came at me with a deal, and first they told me that they were going to charge me with this. I need to do pretrial intervention. Go ahead and plead to the felony and take pretrial intervention. And I said, I can't do that. I'm a bondsman, and I'll lose my license, and I'll never, you know. I said, it's not right. So they said, well, you were armed. We saw the videos, and you were armed. In Florida, we have a 10-20 law. You're going to get an automatic 10 years for having a firearm in the commission of a felony. And, man, they're stacking this thing up on me left and right. So I said, well, I wasn't going to plead to it for 5 years. You know, daggum well, I ain't going for 15. So, you know, they went away for a while, and then they came back. Well, when they came back, they offered me a plea deal, a simple touch strike battery, which is a misdemeanor. So I called the state of Florida, and I said, listen, now, see, in Florida, in any jurisdiction, I guess, the Department of Financial Services is the money man of the state, so to speak. And being a bondsman, it's not just a term. I'm an officer of the court. I'm an equal to, and the fact that you got the bailiff, you got me, the judge, and the prosecutor, and then you can bring in the attorneys. They're also officers of the court, but I'm actually rated higher than that. Our attorney can get you out of jail. Bondsman can. So I'm an officer of the court. So the minute that you're arrested as a bondsman for any kind of crime, immediately you have to cease and desist business and turn in your license until that case is cleared. In that particular field, you are guilty until proven innocent. I mean, it's not a play on words. It is a fact. You're guilty until you can be proven that you're not guilty. So immediately you surrender your license. You're done. So for a whole year, I was not a bondsman. And then when I took the deal on the simple touch strike battery, which is a misdemeanor, and before I took that deal, they wrote it all up, all nice and special, standard probationary term, state of Florida, and I didn't even like that. And I said, I don't really like signing any of this stuff because you're causing me to have to lie on somebody. And what? Yeah, I'm lying on myself because I know daggone well I didn't do nothing wrong, and you got me lying on myself here. So, but I'm going to do you deal because I don't want to take any kind of chance of going to prison for 15 years. And as we look back on it, everybody that's ever been charged facing 15 years in that town has done 15 years or they're on the way to doing it. So I took their deal after I called the state and I asked them and they said, yeah, misdemeanor, as long as it's not a crime of moral turpitude, you'll be fine. You'll get your license back. Now, at the time, I'd only lost one license. I was only concerned about one license and one license only, and that was my bail bonds. So I was reinstated after about a year, and I took the deal. And my terms of probation showed that anybody that would read the terms of probation, stamped out by the judge, would show that all this stuff you've been reading online, oh, he's a grifter, and he was a con man, and they ran him out of town, and all this nasty stuff. Well, I happened to call the judge at home this morning. I did that once before, and got chewed out by my attorney because attorneys can't even do that. You know, they can't call judges at home. That's not proper. Well, I called Mr. Ed Hedstrom this morning, spoke to his wife for a little bit, and she was wishing me well and loved me to death. And apparently my judge now is the senior judge in the 7th Judicial System, and he's the highest-ranking judge up there, kind of like a substitute, they kind of said. And I'd missed him. He probably went fishing or something, and lo and behold, a few minutes later, Mr. Ed called me back, and he said, give me a call back. I missed you. So I called the judge. Now, this is the judge that presided over my case. And, you know, most people think I was whacked to be calling this guy at home, but I did. And he said, tell me how it went. I said, it went great. I said, I've been fully reinstated and everything. And I said, and really, Judge, you're the one that saved my life. And had I known what I know now about you then, I wouldn't have walked in the courtroom. I'd have probably ran because I seen you the other night. I almost dropped my Chinese food all over the floor. You were sending people to prison for life for murder. And he was on TV, and it was a big hoopla going on. But I said, well, Judge, I said, I'm sorry for everything, and I appreciate the fact that you wrote my deal out the way you did. See, the judge wrote. Now, we've checked this, and there's no other defendant anywhere in the United States of America who has ever done any probation time, not even a cop on probation. No one has had the terminology written into their declaration of probation like I did. The only thing they really wanted was for me to stay out of that jurisdiction for a year. They didn't want me messing with Mr. Snodgrass. Leave him alone for a year. Okay, everything's a year. I had to be dope tested. Why, I don't know, but I was randomly dope tested for pharmaceutical drugs, any kind of drugs you can think of, over that course of that year. At any time they beckoned me to call, I was able to do my probation with the people there in Putnam County by mail. I could report in by mail. Most probationary people cannot drink. It said I could drink, but I could not drink into excess. It said most of them can't be around known felons. Mine said I could be around known felons as long as in scope and course and study of my business. And nobody on probation has ever been able to have bullets for a gun, let alone the verbiage that they put into mine. Item 14 says, defendant may carry, own, and possess a firearm. Okay, said right into my thing that I could actually carry, own, possess, and carry a firearm. Judge wrote that right in there. So that was my saving grace, because state of Florida came after me and, of course, took my concealed weapons license from me. They took my private investigator license from me. They took my open carry license from me, and they took my agency away from me, case closed. So I lost all those licenses after I accepted this plea deal. And the reason being is simple touch strike battery is likened to them in the law under 790, I think it is. It's a crime of violence. So it is this: if I was at the bar and reared back and knocked your brake shoes off, and me and you were scrubbing and I had started the fight, and, you know, or I had been in a domestic altercation with a family member or something like that, and that's a crime of violence, and you are not allowed to be a bondsman or carry a firearm ever. You're done. And my argument was, and I took it all the way to the 4th District Court of Appeals, pro se myself, and I argued it and argued it. And when it got to the steps of the 4th District Court of Appeals, I said, oof, I don't really want them to rule on this because I think I got them here. I think I'm legit, because a judge who presided over my case and a state attorney who presided over my case, and, of course, my lawyer, keeping them all in check there, all agreed on my probationary terms that I may own, possess, and carry a firearm. Now, I don't think the judge, if I was violent, would have done that, and that was by saving grace. So when I talked to the judge, Mr. Hedstrom, this morning, he said, man, because I had called him before, and I said, Judge, they ain't playing right. He goes, who is this? I said, Cobra. He says, Cobra, what's your name? I said, William Stubbs. I figured, hey, it's on, but whatever. I can't make a living, so put me in jail, whatever. I didn't know it was wrong to call the judge at home. And he goes, what's going on? I said, Judge, they ain't playing by the rules. I said, they ain't honoring a thing. I've been lost my license, Ben. They got me messed up. Can you make a phone call? He says, no, I can't. That would be unethical. I said, well, I don't want you to do anything unethical, Judge. He goes, well, I'd get your attorney, take it back into court and fight them and do this and that and bring the case back again. Okay. I said, you know what? Man with ain't no money, ain't got no job, ain't going to be able to bring no case against nobody, so I'm on my own again. So this morning when I called him, I said, Judge, I've been reinstated 100%. And I said, now I'm sorry for anything trouble that caused up there. I said, they writing about me on the Internet saying I'm a grifter and I've been run out of town and I'm shameless and all this stuff. He said to me straight up, and I quote, bullshit. He said, Cobra, That's the first time I've cussed on this radio show, folks, and I'm just quoting you. Okay?
It wasn't even a bad one.
Yeah, well, that's what he said. And he said, listen to me. You got a pen in your hand. I said, I get one. He said, here's my address. And if I'm lying, I'm dying. He said, here's my address. I want you, where you at? I said, I'm Tallahassee. Where are you rain from? I said, Fort Lauderdale. He goes, all right, when you get back down there, I want you to send me a handful of your business cards. And let me tell you something. If I ever need a private investigator, or anybody I know happens to need a private investigator, you're the private investigator. You hear what I'm saying? I said, yes, sir, Your Honor, I do, and it's an honor that you would say that to me, quote, unquote. He's probably listening. If he is, that's an honorable man. I'm going to tell you right now. Also, my daughter, Rebecca, is probably sitting there listening, and I'm going to say, y'all do good. Don't take a chance with trying to do something a little wrong, hoping it's going to turn out right, like I did when I was a little feller, because it might not. But end of the day, the state of Florida, there's a lot of people I could thank, all the way down the list that have stepped up for me. They've seen the videos. This should have never happened to me. This should have never happened to where I lost a moment's worth of sleep over the thing. But, Simon, it gets to this sometimes. I forgot who I was, and then I forgot whose I was. And the minute I remembered who I was and who I belonged to, you know, God showed up, and it was on. You know, it was just, I just thank everybody that stood by me and believed in me. And, you know, a lot of people backed off because I know secrets. I mean, I've been in this business. I'm 54. I've worked with, in fact, one saving grace was, and I don't mind telling the world about it, I was activated, DEA, Department of Drug Interdiction, okay? And there was a major bust that went down, and I actually went undercover wearing a wire and did some of this stuff in the past year, and then got deactivated and reactivated, and worked with the sheriff's office. I'm a volunteer posse member. I have served countless amounts of warrants. I've worked with the federal government, the FBI investigation. In fact, I've an ongoing case right now. I mean, anybody can check this out. I mean, there's no secret to it. I have worked with law enforcement dang near my whole life and done a lot of undercover, very serious stuff. And shout out to Mr. Bob Dicker there. He could have testified to it. In fact, he said back in 95 that a couple of the cases that the feds had on me hadn't quite ran out yet. And always, he would always introduce me like that. I have saved Obama's life. I believe so. There was death threats of a guy that had a death plot to kill Senator Obama and Obama. And this case was reported, and he was arrested and spent 18 months in prison. In fact, he was the husband of the woman who you wrote about that I had caught the lizards for. I didn't know it was the same guy until I got down there. And sure, lo and behold, he just got out of prison. And, of course, he never knew. He'll know today that I'm the guy that turned him into the Secret Service and had him arrested. But the reason I mentioned that is Obama sent a thing the other day and says, would you like to buy Obama lunch? I wrote back and I says, shit, I saved the man's life. What has he done for me? Buy me lunch. So I don't get any more mail from them anymore. But, but at the end of the day, I mean, basically, I think what had happened was, is, listen, everybody's nerve was on the last end of it, and a charge was bought. And then all of a sudden somebody had to, you know, do something about it and everything. But I assure you, for those who know Judge Ed Hedstrom, if you don't believe what I'm saying, you reach out and contact him, the people in law enforcement up there. I've spoken to Jeff Hardy several times. He's beside himself with all the crap they've been saying about me and stuff on there. He told me I'm welcome in his town anytime, that his department was not mad at him. And see, what people don't know is Jeff Hardy's partner happens to be my best friend's partner. He used to be a deputy sheriff in Broward County, and they don't know my connections in law enforcement. And as I was saying earlier, a lot of my law enforcement friends and stuff backed off. I mean, I know secrets. Man, I've been around for a long, long time. And if I would have said, boo, I would have never been mentioned again. I would have never been facing no 15 years in prison, but I'm a stand-up. When I say a stand-up guy, I am the stand-up guy. Stand-up guys. I never squealed, said a word about anything. I took my licks, and for 3 years I have struggled picking up pop bottles, doing this, little odd jobs and everything else. And I'm more talented than that. But I refused to give up. A couple times I came close, but then I remembered whose I was. And you know what? I never missed a meal or a place to sleep or anything like that. I mean, God took care of me. And I have to give all the credit, even though he gave me a worldly amount of knowledge. I would just tell you that God, and I've tried to clean up my act as far as cussing. That's probably the worst thing I do. And if you've seen some of this stuff, I can be around a preacher for a little while, and I have him cussing. You know, it's just the nature of the beast that I deal with. But a lot of people just don't know, you know, like in the bail bonds and the PI. And somebody was asking me, so what's the significance of a PI?
Yeah, I actually,
you wanted to know.
Let me ask you that. You have your licenses restored, and I have a couple of questions. They're probably going to sound really, really stupid to you, but you have to understand that I'm a mere mortal, as are most of the listeners. So please bear with me. What is the significance of a PI license? What does it enable you to do that I can't?
Well, by definition, and I'm going to read you from the little private investigator handbook. By definition, it's the investigation by a person or purpose or persons for the purpose of obtaining information with reference to any of the following matters: A, crime or wrongdoings done or threatened against the United States or any state or territory of the United States when operating under express written authority of the government official responsible for authorizing such investigation. B, the identity, habits, conduct, movements, whereabouts, affiliations, associations, transactions, reputation, or character of any society, person, or group of persons. Boy, that sounds like Twitter, doesn't it? The credibility of witnesses or other persons, the whereabouts of missing persons, owners of abandoned property or estranged property or heirs to estates, the location or recovery of lost or stolen property, the causes and origin of or responsibility for fires, libels, slanders, losses, accidents, damage, or injuries to real or personal property, the business of securing evidence to be used before investigating committees or boards of award or arbitration or in trial of civil or criminal cases, and the preparation therefore. So that's why and what
okay.
You do.
Whoa, but why can't I do any of that?
Mm-mm.
What's the difference?
I think it's somewhere between a $2,000 and a $5,000 fine, and some probably jail time, I guess, for you doing investigation work without no license. And you're not going to be able to be granted access to any of that stuff that you're going to need to get. You know, that you're going to need access to. And
now we're getting to the nits and grits. Access to what stuff?
Records, personal records, you know, different. What are you going to tell the police officer when he catches you sitting out at the end of Mary Jo Lane's house sitting out there? If you're not a private investigator checking on things, you'd all be arrested for stalking, trespassing, or something of this nature. But if you're there on official status, you say, well, look, I'm checking out Miss Mary Jane over here. I think she's been dumping her garbage over there, and I need to find out. You know, it could be something as simple as whose dogs are barking on the street. What's going on over here? You know, there's a lot to it. I mean, it's not just the fact that you want to go on the internet and start looking up people and stuff. there's a whole lot more to conducting an investigation than just armchair quarterbacking the thing and, you know, or reading somebody else's news report and reporting on that. You know,
we're about to lose our live listeners, but live listeners, live listeners, fear not. This whole program is being recorded for posterity, and will be available for rerun. You will be able to stream it direct from Blogger News or download it from iTunes.
Give a shout out for a second. I've seen some queries out there about this particular lawyer that I have aligned myself with, and some say he's just a old construction lawyer. And, you know, I'll tell you what, he's a Midwest farm boy, and he is a construction lawyer. But one of his small cases has been about $1 billion and dealing with 200-plus persons. See, a construction lawyer has to know more than any other lawyer, and they're not just dealing with one-on-one and onesie-twosies and threesie-foursies. I saw a warehouse one time with 10,000 square feet, boxes stacked to the roof, and you know this construction lawyer had to know everything in every one of them bedgum boxes. And you have to be a very smart individual because you're not only dealing with your plaintiff and your defendant, you're dealing with the frickin' bail, you know, the bonds carriers, the insurance companies, the banks, the owners of the property, the contractors, subcontractors, and that's plural, many, many subcontractors. So all those little haters out there that like to make fun of these construction attorneys, back in 1990, there was probably, 10,000-plus construction lawyers in the state of Florida. Well, the law's changed up, and now you'll be hard-pressed to find 1,000 because it is a very extreme practice, and they have, they're very well versed in many forms of law, from family practice to First Amendment law to God knows what all these guys know. And I'll tell you what, Doug Roberts, who I'm speaking of, is a very intelligent individual. In fact, he worked for a man named Larry Livey. Well, if you pick up any book, Florida Construction Lien Law, which is the laws that, you know, people can lean on your house and stuff like that. It's a big old thick book, and it's a 4-year deal to go through and know all this stuff at any local college. He wrote that and wrote most of the laws. Well, Doug Roberts purchased the law firm from Larry. So that kind of puts Doug Roberts on the top of his mountain and probably one of the most feared individuals to walk into a courtroom. And some of the folks that have know me and have had the pleasure, and sometimes not too good a pleasure, of meeting Doug, finds out that for a Midwestern farm boy, be forewarned, y'all not be making fun of something you don't know something about.
Okay, another question for you, and it's one that I quite frankly have. You know, I'm just dumb. I've never owned a gun. I have no interest in doing so.
You're not one of them libbers, are you? You're not one of them fellers, are you? If somebody broke in your house, I have to shoot them for you. Is that the kind of fellow you are, or what?
Exactly.
But the whole
area of gun licenses, there seems to be about 8 gazillion different types of license. There's what? Concealed, open carry, and who knows what else. What do they actually mean?
Well, in the state of Florida, in fact, I have one here someplace. I just got it. I don't know where I got it, but anyway, it's a concealed weapon or firearm. You know, certain knife blades that are over 4 inches or switchblades, you know, mace, anything that can be used as a weapon against another party that you have concealed about your body, up into including a firearm, if you do not have a license and you are caught carrying a concealed weapon or concealed firearm, that's a arrestable offense. So Florida, a long time ago, used to have it was a two-move deal. We had to have it in a case, and you had to have it locked, and you had to have it in your trunk, and you had to have a pit bull guarding it, and somebody come up and say, give me your money, hold on a minute, pit bull, move, open the thing. Wait a minute, I got to find my key, get my gun out here, because I'm fixing to shoot your ass. Well, the state and the people to be decided that, you know, that's just too many moves. He ought to be able to pull his pistol out and defend his property, you know, right then and there. So how are we going to make this all happen? So they came up with we don't want people open carrying. When the law first came into effect, man, we had people walking in Walmart and stuff with 357 Magnum slung over their shoulder and walking down the road with guns. I mean, you thought this was the old Wild West. Well, my God, they got a concealed weapons for random going and started issuing these licenses. And to qualify, you need not be a convicted felon. You don't need to be committing no crimes of violence or anything like that, and pretty squeaky clean. And you go through a Florida Department of Law Enforcement fingerprint check, FBI backgrounds, all this stuff, and you got to be mentally competent. You can't be smoking no marijuana. You can't be doing no dope, drugs, none of that stuff. No drinking alcohol. You ain't never been in no insane asylum. So, I mean, just the fact that I have a firearms permit would let people know, hey, I'm no Looney Tune, okay? So then if you're going to be a licensed investigator or a guard of some sorts, a bodyguard or gosh knows, I'm trying to think what it is. It's a D license. That's all I know it as, a D license. Security guard. And you want to carry a gun, your concealed weapons does not apply. In other words, I'm sitting here in my truck and some officer walked up and, hey, what are you doing? I'm watching Joe Smith down here rob, you know, Sherry Lee's trash or something. Oh, okay. Are you armed? Yes, sir, I am. Would you mind showing me your license? And I show him my CCW license, which is concealed weapons permit. I'm in violation of state statute. I also have to have, if I'm working as a armed investigator, I have to have what is known as a G license, which is a statewide firearms license. And the only time that is allowed to be open carry, because that's still a concealed weapons license, but it's statewide, and it allows you to go into bars, and as long as you're working, it allows you to go places that you weren't normally allowed to go with a CCW, as long as it's in the scope and course of study of your business. So those two licenses differ dramatically. Then there's what's called getting a secondary license. Like I've just applied for something I never had before, I'm a variance, to be able to carry a shotgun. And the reason being because I transport prisoners and cash and bail bonds, and bail bonds are, you know, a tradable device. Somebody could steal those. And so I've applied for a waiver to be able to tote a shotgun as well. Now, I also have what's called a duck stamp. Now, a duck stamp is a slang term for permission to own a fully automatic machine gun. And I have a machine gun, and actually I bought the machine gun outright and then bought a license for that particular machine gun. Otherwise, I would have to have a class three license in order to own a machine gun, but that would allow me to have many machine guns. And, you know, I wouldn't have to have each one prescribed. So I have a federal firearms duck stamp, which allows me to carry a machine gun, which is pull the trigger, hold the trigger, and it continues to fire, unlike semi-automatic where you have to pull the trigger for each shot to go off. I just made application for my G because you have to have your C in possession before you can apply a G. So yesterday I applied for my G, and within a few weeks I'll have that G and the variance for the shotgun as well. And I have a CCW. In fact, they issued my concealed weapons permit to me first. So that I got first. And reason being is I was hunting 1 year after my arrest, after my bond cleared, and I went on probation. I was immediately taking prisoners, picking them up and taking them to the jail immediately by myself. And I did not have a gun. And I was you know, a lot of people won't even come out the house if they, you know, and here I am kicking in doors and stuff. Freeze, get on the ground, and all I got. So I was like Dog the Bounty Hunter. I had a dadgum can of spray mace and was taking in some pretty bad individuals. And everybody was telling me, Cobra, man, you know, I mean, you got kids, you got to support, man. I said, listen, you get it how you live. You know, you got to do what you got to do to survive. So, you know, they were haggling with me, oh, he's not a bondsman. Well, I assure you that 1 year after, the minute that my felony thing went away, I got my bail bond license back, and I was limping along, you know. And people ought to know that I got some guts, because I would go make apprehensions. You know, you see the police show up, force, a SWAT team coming. I had to eat. My refrigerator was empty. So if it mean, you know, I ain't going to eat tomorrow, or I got to go grab this feller, well, you pull your bootstraps up and you run in there and you get him. Simple as that. Now, not the smartest thing in the world to do, but through nutrition, and you just do what you got to do, period. You know. But thank God that, you know, he answered my prayers, man, and restored me. You know.
So you're now back in the saddle. So what's next in the life and times of William Cobra Storbs?
Well, right now I'm working a domestic case out of Tallahassee, which involves a three-state deal through Tennessee, which I'm going to be headed out for Tennessee in the next day or so around Nashville, and then over to some parts of the Carolinas called Kakalaki, North Kakalaki, South Kakalaki. And then as I come back, I have been hired by a major law firm, the law firm of Tripp Scott out of Fort Lauderdale, Florida, on a case that I already know something about, but I've been hired on that case to do some investigative work for a client that, or against a person, I guess, no names mentioned, but against somebody that's already has them as a legal team. And behind that, I tell you what, I got so many things. I had a contract with Discovery ID prior to my arrest, and being as I was arrested and charged with a felony, that contract could not be fulfilled because they could not place insurance on me. They couldn't get insurance because I was out on a felony bond. So now my producer, along with the producers of Necessary Evil and Media Arts, have decided to go forward with that. And then I got an offer a couple days ago from that TV station, the same one that Baez was going to go to work for. What's the name of them people?
Telemundo?
Telemundo, yes. In fact, another gentleman wants to open a training facility for private investigators and bondsmen. And anybody will tell you in the state, there's no one that knows any more about on the bond side. Now, this is not teaching bail bonds so you can get a license. This is once you have a license and you want to continue that license out and be, you know, a recovery agent, which we don't really support that terminology anymore, but just a person that goes out and snatches bodies. Teach the tracking to them, teach how they, the procedure when they get them, the safeguarding of their prisoner once they get them, the handoff of that prisoner to the jail, the typical forms, what you need to know, what not to know. And, I mean, after you've arrested over 8,500 individuals, I pretty much know just about everything there is to know about doing that. So they've asked me to be an instructor. And Telemundo, one of my buddies, is hooked up real well. He's done three shows with Telemundo, and it's something that they would like to, you know, it's pretty exciting. And every man that, you know, is a he-man, he want to be a bounty hunter. I mean, I've been in so many different situations, and they've been trying to pick up girls in bars, and you know what I do for a living? What? I'm a bounty hunter. Are you really? And I just, like, chagrin. I go, oh, my God, you mess with, oh, my God, you mess with fugitives and stuff? Are you crazy? You know, and then they'll find out, who was that guy? That was Cobra. Oh, shit, then they die because, they, you know, I don't have to go around.
Now, the politically correct term is not bounty hunter.
Correct.
I mean, I understand that it's verboten for you to call yourself that.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. Everybody knows that I'm a bounty hunter, but the thing of it is I'm not a bounty hunter just by the fact that I have a license as a surety agent, a bail bondsman. The Sally Burt, a good friend of mine, if she's listening, shout out to her. She got the law changed. There was a guy by name, and you probably read his book or seen his book, Bob Burton. Bob Burton was the bounty hunter, state of Florida, and he put such a black eye on us that the law was changed pretty much strictly for him, that the use and terminology of bounty hunter is a third-degree felony. A guy like Padilla comes into town and tries to arrest someone. He's going to jail. This state does not look upon bounty hunting. Everybody calls me a bounty hunter. In fact, they call the JAG and the Jim Viola's people down at Sunshine State Bail Bonds, you know, the bounty girls and stuff. And, you know, I don't go knocking on nobody's door and screaming out, bounty hunter. You know, they could probably try to jam me up on that. But truthfully, if you are a licensed surety agent under 903, in fact, my bail bond license, I was trying to get a new one because the corner chipped off. I was picking a door with it rather than kick the door down. I was trying to sneak in. I chipped a piece of my license off. But it says, this licensee has the power of arrest as authorized by Section 903.22 and 903.29 of the Florida statutes and Taylor versus Tainer, 83, United States, 366, 2-1 left edition, which is 1872. And I had sent that out to some folks, Taylor versus Tainer on 1872. And basically, my arresting of an individual is not by a new statute or a new something or anything. My arrest of an individual is likened to that of an escaping prisoner by the sheriff. So if a prisoner's escaping and the sheriff has all the power to chase his butt down and yoke him and do whatever necessary is, take him back into custody, and he'll get a new charge out of that for escape, but he doesn't need a warrant to go after him. And a lot of people, you know, well, you're kicking in people's doors. Yeah, that's right. And if you get out on bond and I call you, come out, and you don't come out, I'm coming in. And I don't need a warrant for that, you know. And I noticed you put that in there in your thing the other night, and somebody commented on it. Listen, for everybody that doesn't know, Simon is a dear friend of mine, and I would never kick his door in, but that was something nice to say. In fact, I couldn't be kicking your door in. If you recall, I had a major fugitive strapped down in the back of that gun vehicle when I pulled in there. Now, that was just probably the only thing. I mean, I actually brought a major felon to your door, you know. So I think that shocked you. I didn't think it would be a good idea to bring this felon to
you. And of course, you happen to do this at, you know, the prime commute time in the morning. Yeah, so all of the neighbors are slowing down, you know.
Oh, yeah.
They're driving past going,
yeah.
What?
And him in
the
there with
hell?
A little red pink jumpsuit on, they're probably thinking he's chained up, looked like Gulliver from the times of Gulliver, you know. And I said, well, I don't know if, and it's a good thing I stopped on the way up to Baton Rouge, because on the way back from Baton Rouge, I blew past you, went to New Orleans. I'm like, whoa, I got way sidetracked. So it's a good thing I stopped on the way, but, you know, just for your listening there, wrap it up, or whoever it was, I wasn't going to kick down Simon's door. He's a friend of mine, but I might kick your door in if you ever get out on bond. I hope I get your paper. That's the only thing I hope. I hope all these haters, if they ever do get arrested, I hope the bondsmen remember, hey, this one right here was picking on Cobra. Let's just trade him the paper. And see, we do trade paper a lot. And if they ever happen to give me paper, boy, it's on. I just got to have a piece of paper with your name on it. That's all I got to have. And it's off to the races.
Okay. My automated producer is whining in my ear. So I need to wrap this up. Cobra, it's been great to talk to you. And I'm sure I speak for everyone at Blogger News in wishing you every success. And you can rest assured that certainly Jan and I were just over the moon when we heard the good news that you've been restored back to your evil self.
Yes, my wild and crazy self, yes. Yes. And like I say, yeah, I give the credit to God, but I'll tell you, he used servants here on the ground, and those folks know who they are, and for privacy's sake, I wouldn't mention them, but for every hater that kept my name out there, thank you. And for every friend that prayed for me, thank you. And Simon, I honor you and honor our friendship, and I really appreciate you having the faith in me and standing by me when most didn't. Appreciate you, man. I really do.
Cobra, my pleasure, or our pleasure. I'll speak for Jan on that.
You tell Jan to have a good one, too. Hope she's feeling better.
Yeah, I certainly will. Okay, this is Simon Barrett for Blogger News Network. I want to wish everyone a happy and safe day, and we're getting very close to Christmas, so I'm going to say it, politically incorrect, Merry Christmas!
Amen. Some of y'all ain't getting nothing but switches.
till next time, goodbye.
Yeah, bye-bye.